This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. There was snow on the ground the last time Ohio's COVID case count was this high. That's a headline from our friends at Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, describing the current surge in cases we're seeing across our three-state area. And reporter Joe Ingles is with us now to talk about COVID in Ohio. Joe, welcome back to our show.
Great to be there.
Well, you know, I really just can't believe we're still talking about this like this, but
yeah, I can't either.
Oh man, it's just so very serious again. And it's even harder to talk about, I suppose, because of that brief window we seemed to enjoy earlier in the summer where restrictions were being lifted. A lot of people were vaccinated and those of us who were vaccinated felt safe about going places again. And now here we are. What are we seeing in Ohio?
Well, in Ohio, we are seeing a mess right now. You know, when we look at the cases, and they look at two-week averages, if you look at the cases in early July, and this is a month after the restrictions came off, there were 17 new cases a day on average. Now, that's gone up to 400 a day on average. And in many southeast counties of the state, southeastern counties, that's topping 1,000. And that's a really conservative estimate when you consider that during the past few days, the numbers of cases have been higher. So that's going to skew even higher. We're seeing schools that are closing. We're seeing schools that are having all kinds of difficulties with not having enough bus drivers, not having enough teachers, the high absentee rates among students. And it's causing a lot of havoc for kids who are trying to get an in-person education. And right now, the school boards are saying that the school board association is saying that the school boards want lawmakers to allow them more flexibility so that they can do some remote learning if they need to, if these situations get bad.
We're going to dive more into the situation facing the schools in just a moment. But just to put this into raw numbers here, you reported that Dr. Bruce Vanderhoff, the director of the Ohio Department of Health, reminded us that back in July, counties in Ohio were averaging 17 cases of COVID per 100,000 people over a two-week period, and now it's an average of 400. So, I mean, it's just such a significant rise. And I understand that Dr. Vanderhoff is talking about the Delta variant playing a pretty significant role in this.
Yeah, you know, the thing is that this Delta variant makes people sicker quicker. And it is targeting people who, if you remember, when this whole thing started, the people who were most at risk were people who were older, people who had underlying medical conditions. Now the hospitals are seeing younger people in their 20s, 30s, 40s who have no underlying conditions, who are getting very sick and dying from it. And the children's hospitals are seeing a lot of children. In addition to the RSV cases, which that's something totally different there, but a virus that goes around with kids. There are a lot of those cases. But in addition to those, there are COVID cases, and they are wreaking havoc on these young kids. And the pediatricians say many of those kids, they didn't have any pre-existing conditions.
Well, we are noticing that kids are contracting this virus in higher numbers than they had been previously in this pandemic, and that is happening just as kids are returning to schools. We're hearing from children's hospitals talking about increased numbers there. What are we seeing at some of the hospitals that serve children in Ohio?
Yes, yeah, some of those hospitals are saying that they're getting close to reaching capacity. We've heard of some of these hospitals having numbers that are high enough that they have five kids maybe in ICU. And I think that was actually Cincinnati that said they had five earlier this week, had five kids in ICU. Two were on ventilators, and one of the two that was on a ventilator did not have pre-existing conditions. So we're not talking about kids who maybe already are battling cancer or some kind of other condition. We're talking about normal kids who were healthy, and they're getting COVID, and they're ending up in the hospital, and the hospitals are warning right now that they are nearing capacity. And that's a big problem as we go into the school year, and there is bound to be more spread.
Joe, you reported pediatric doctors are saying that the best way to fight COVID in kids right now is to get them vaccinated if they are eligible. We should note that kids under 12 are still not yet eligible in this country, but also they should be wearing masks inside buildings and crowded spaces. So I can think of a school being inside and also crowded. You mentioned just a little bit ago, Joe, that some school district leaders or teachers are suggesting that lawmakers should give them more flexibility to address the situation that they're facing with rising cases in kids. What type of flexibility do they feel they lack right now?
Well, if you remember last year, the way that school districts could deal with this is that if they had a high COVID spread, they could, and a lot of them just went remote for a period of months before they could get back into the classrooms. And they would do online lessons. And now, though, the way that, and that was a special, you know, dispensation that was given to them for last year, expired at the end of the last school year. So this summer, schools had to decide if they wanted to teach in person or if they wanted to do what's known as kind of blended learning, which is a combination of in-person and on computer online learning. And so we saw that some of the districts did go with a blended learning plan, but they had to make the arrangements to do that back in the summer. Now, as we just talked about, you know, in the summer, those numbers weren't nearly as high. So a lot of school districts went into this year thinking, hey, we're going to be in person finally. We're going to catch these kids up. We're going to get them where they need to be. And, you know, they get them in school and outbreaks are happening and they do not have a blended learning plan. So that means that if the lawmakers don't give that authority to the schools, they're going to be facing maybe, you know, having horrible situations in the summer. Maybe they'd have to go through the summer. Maybe they'd, you know, have to have longer school days. And who knows how they'd have to compensate. But they're saying, hey, give us the chance to do more of this online learning when these kind of things happen.
We're talking with Joe Ingles of Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Well, where is Governor DeWine on this? He was pretty active last year, certainly earlier in the pandemic, with being comfortable in extending orders related to mask wearing and closures of situations like schools or businesses. Where is he now on, for example, a mask mandate for school districts?
Well, Governor DeWine has been adamant that he is not going to put another mask mandate in place. He says there's no appetite for it. And one of the reasons he's saying that is that lawmakers snapped back at him last year when he put those mandates in place. You can remember that there were angry mobs at the State House, people who were out there saying, you know, we don't like this. We do not want these restrictions on businesses and schools and people in general. And so, and a lot of people in his own party are against this. And they have the legislature, the Republican legislature has passed limits since then on how things can be handled at the state level and the authority that the government, that the governor has. He does, if he wanted to pass a mask mandate tomorrow, oh, sure, he could go ahead and say, you know, I'm going to issue a mask mandate via executive order. But you know what could happen is the legislature could come back in the next day and reverse it. So, and he knows that. So he's basically, you know, saying, I wear your mask, get your vaccine. But if it comes to mandating anything, I'm going to be here on the sidelines because I don't feel like I have the authority to do that anymore.
And I'm sure Governor DeWine has watched what has happened to his neighbor to the south, Governor Beshear of Kentucky, who did issue a mask mandate for all public schools due to the rising cases. And then was told by the Kentucky Supreme Court that he does not have the type of executive authority that he had been acting on previously. For students or for parents who want their kids in Kentucky to be wearing masks while in school, the Kentucky Board of Education took action. So kids in Kentucky public schools are wearing masks, but we're still seeing school districts have to close there as well. So it's just a tough situation all around for young people.
Right.
Joe Ingles, you reported something else that Governor DeWine is not yet taking any action on, and this is something called ivermectin. It's commonly been referred to as horse dewormer. It is apparently used in people in some certain ways, but not for COVID-19. What's Correct. Going on with this drug right now, and what's the concern?
Well, ivermectin is a prescription drug that can be used in people by prescription to get rid of worms. It's not a real common drug because, I mean, how many people really have a worm problem, you know? So it's not something that's prescribed, you know, in large numbers. But a lot of people, to get around that prescription issue, they're going to these feed supply, farmer supply stores, and they're buying the animal version of it. And so poison control calls are going up significantly because, as you can imagine, and if you're talking about a horse or a cow, they are much larger than a human, and the formulation for them would be much higher. So it's causing a lot of problems. I had asked earlier this week if Attorney General Dave Yost would step in, because last year when there was a different drug that was being used off-label, he did step in at that point because the pharmacist had asked him to. But it turns out that he's not going to step in. The pharmacy board says they are taking action. They're, you know, getting in touch with pharmacists who have been prescribing off-label and telling them you cannot do that. But that's the extent of their action. And, you know, it's one of these situations where there are not the controls on it that there were last year when we saw some other drugs being used in a similar way.
And we saw a weird, I shouldn't say weird, but we saw a court case out of Butler County where someone had been prescribed ivermectin. And
it was different, yeah.
Yeah, uh-huh. What happened there?
Well, that case, the person was in the hospital and the family wanted the doctor to use ivermectin. The doctor was saying, you know, hey, I can't use ivermectin. It's not something I can do. So it ended up in court, and the court said, yes, the doctor can indeed use ivermectin. But, you know, this drug is not FDA approved for this reason. And even the FDA itself came out last week and said, they put up a picture of an animal and says, you are not a horse or a cow. Stop it. You know, they're issuing these warnings that this is not something you should be taking. Do not take this drug. And still, people are taking the drug, and they're landing up in hospitals after doing so, and it's a problem. I mean, we've seen Fox News host or Fox Entertainment host, however we want to put that, Tucker Carlson has been talking about it on his show, and a lot of people think, hey, this is something I can do.
We just saw Joe Rogan, who hosts the world's most popular mm-hmm. podcast, contract COVID and say that as part of the massive COVID cocktail he's taking to treat it, ivermectin is there. So
yep.
A lot of weird information out there on that. Joe Ingles yep. is a reporter with Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Joe, always a pleasure to have you. I hope you enjoy your long weekend in spite of everything we've had to report on this week.
Oh, it's been a week. Thank you very much for having me.
Our pleasure. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Mungs. Hospitals are seeing a rise in patients with severe cases of COVID-19, and they are sounding the alarm. And last year, we had far lower flu cases than usual, likely due to masking and social distancing to mitigate COVID. But what does that mean for our immunity this coming flu season? Inquirer reporter Ann Saker joins us now. Ann, happy Friday. Welcome back to our show.
Same to you, Michael. Thanks so much for inviting me again.
Well, we're glad to have you. And as I told Joe Ingles in the previous segment, I'm just so surprised or despondent that we're still talking about this the way we're talking about it after all of this time. And let's transition to a more local focus on COVID. We're hearing from the local hospitals that they're filling up.
That's correct. About 10 days ago, we got a tip from someone at UC Health saying that the hospital was at capacity, which is a term that has a very specific meaning in this instance. And that is that they had so much traffic in their own ER at University of Cincinnati Medical Center that they put out the word to the Hamilton County Communications Center and thus to all the emergency responders that UCMC could only at that time take patients who had trauma, stroke, or burn, the most serious kinds of cases. And if you had something else, you would have to go to another hospital in this area for emergency treatment. We subsequently learned that UCMC has been at capacity three times in the past 30 days for that very reason, that the surge in cases in the ER was just not acceptable for them to take in just anyone. Now, of course, UC officials said, if you are in the ambulance and you insist on going to University of Cincinnati Medical Center, well, they have to take you because otherwise it's kidnapping. But the point of a network where hospitals and emergency responders can communicate with each other is to help get an emergency patient to the right ER for the right kind of care. And the last place you want to go under those circumstances is an ER that cannot take patients right away. It's more a matter of balancing the load is the term that they use.
The University of Cincinnati Medical Center is of particular importance in this region because it's if they are struggling to keep their numbers down, this is a place where all of those unfortunate shootings take victims to. It treats a lot of low-income people in emergency situations. So, I mean, if they're only taking people with the most serious of situations because of COVID, I mean, it leaves a lot of people out on the sidelines.
Well, if you are in an ambulance, you'll be able to go. The ambulance will take you somewhere else. But if you have a friend who drives you to the hospital and drops you off, you can expect to wait for hours and hours and hours. And I have heard of a number of instances where people went and spent many hours waiting for care because the hospital is processing so much medicine right now. What the hospitals tell us is that these kinds of heavy situations are things that they manage all the time. The difficulty now is that it has been going on for so long that doctors and nurses and caregivers are exhausted. So you add that layer into the mix and it just becomes a complicating practice of medicine. Because the system is under strain.
And not only has it been under strain for a prolonged period of time, you reported that Health Commissioner Greg Kesterman, Hamilton County Health Commissioner Greg Kesterman, says there's no end in sight and that all of the metrics at local hospitals are pointed in the wrong direction.
And it's been like that for about a month now, where if we had an opportunity to get on top of this, it passed us. And now we are trying to chase after this spiraling caseload. And I think that the tools that we have at hand have been successful during this pandemic. We just have to want to do them.
That's what I was going to ask next, Anne, is what are local officials saying the answer is here? Because it seems there are answers, but are enough people accepting that answer?
That's the fundamental here. We can't To get on top of a viral infection, a contagion, you need upwards of 90% of people doing what's necessary to block the virus from passing from one person to the next. And that means that's a layered effect. That's getting vaccinated. That's wearing a mask. It's social distancing. It's all the things we've been hearing for 19 months. And I know it sounds exhausting to hear it over and over again, but those are the tools that are most useful and most successful. We've already shown we can do it. So we have to do it again. And I don't know who's the public health officials and the elected officials are doing what they can to persuade people that these are still necessary tools we have to use. Can't make the horse drink after you lead him to water.
Well, we know that there is a bus going around Hamilton County funded by the county through some dollars they received from the federal government to just take vaccines to folks. And they're even giving out $100 gift certificates to people who will get their first vaccine shot. And we talked with Hamilton County Commissioner Alicia Reese just yesterday about that program. And they were excited that they had their busiest day of the 513 bus, as they call it, but still, and I don't want to downplay the success of what they're calling their best day, but that's 52 people.
Right.
And so that number's not fast enough, it seems.
Not only do they have the 513 relief bus, but the county also has three vans that have been going into areas, and the city has operations into areas. But there's, you know, this is, we can, again, this is the government can offer these things, healthcare facilities can offer this stuff, but people have to be willing to take it. And I'm curious as to why this has not yet been constructed as a matter of patriotism and a matter of community building. It's just, I think there needs to be some element of a communal responsibility for each other.
Well, there are some parts of town and that are apparently hit with higher case numbers per capita over the past couple of weeks. And you profiled some of those in your reporting this week. And some of the highest include neighborhoods like Camp Washington, East Westwood, Millvale,
right.
North Fairmont.
Right.
So a lot of these areas. And I know the 513 bus is going to these places. What do we know, if anything, about those particular parts of town and their connection to these increased case numbers?
The vaccination rates in those particular zip codes hover around 30%. There's just immense reluctance to take the vaccine there, and that's where the infection is spreading. It's kind of a textbook exercise of what happens here when you set up a barrier against a virus in a certain population. It's going to go find another population to infect. And that is what we're seeing now.
And we're seeing a dramatic increase in all local counties, just about. We are seeing from week to week, 54% increase in the average daily case count in Warren County, for example, 53% increase week over week in Butler County for the average number of daily cases. Hamilton County seeing about a 32%, Campbell County a 31%. I mean, the state of Kentucky overall is seeing more than a 71% change in the average case count week over week. And it's just so troubling. So I suppose we've learned, Anne, and I apologize, this wasn't specifically in your reporting, but I know you pay attention to a lot of health news. There was some recent reporting out there about the level of protection you might have if you had earlier contracted COVID. And some of that reporting indicated that if you contracted COVID, you might have better immunity to further cases than those of us who have been vaccinated. So are you seeing any folks out there reluctant to vaccines because they had contracted COVID?
Oh, yes. Oh, that is one of the main objections to the vaccine, coming from people who have COVID, who've had COVID and recovered from COVID. Well, I've got an immunity. It's like measles. I've got, or chickenpox. I had it, therefore I can never get it again. And what some of the science is showing now is that it does not make you completely protected against COVID, getting a recurrence of COVID. And the science also apparently shows that vaccines deliver a much broader and a much better immunity against the vaccine than the natural immunity, even after an exposure to COVID. So, I mean, this is still also new. The science of this is still new, and scientists and researchers are trying to process it so that it can be actionable and useful for us. So, you know, what you might have read yesterday may change tomorrow. That doesn't mean what you read yesterday was bad or wrong. It was just that we got better information.
Yeah, I guess that's a challenge of dealing with a novel coronavirus. It's a novel coronavirus, and so it's very challenging. And I suppose
it's actually, yes. And the interesting thing about this, Michael, is that it does flop over into the issue of flu, which is, I'm kind of worried about what we're going to see.
And
you don't know what
you're here to talk about flu as well, because you did some reporting on a study that I believe was that out of France.
Yes, there was a study out of France.
We were doing all this masking last flu season, and we were keeping our distance. Obviously, the COVID mitigation efforts that we were all undertaking as best we could, and while it was effective against COVID in a lot of ways, it seemed to be even more effective against flu. So we had like extremely low flu case counts last year. But what does that mean as another flu season is set to roll around?
As Dr. Josh Shaffron at Children's Hospital told me this past week, you've seen one flu season. You've seen one flu season,
mm-hmm.
meaning we can only learn so much from one season to the next, because It's a virus and it changes, and we don't know how it will hit us this coming year. We might sail through again. Last year, the United States gave out 170 million flu shots, which was about 10% more than the previous year. So it wasn't just all the COVID masking. People got flu shots. And that kept the rate low as well. So I know that the large pharmacy chains have already started giving out flu shots and are encouraging people to get it as soon as you can. You can get a flu shot and a COVID shot at the same time. So that's the necessary step. But again, it's a roll of the dice right now, Michael. I'm not sure we know what we're going to see with flu.
Well, tell us what these French researchers found who are suggesting that there might be something that they call immunity debt.
Right. It's a fascinating term. Immunity debt, according to this particular piece of research, is a suggestion that if you see a very low season of a viral infection, such as flu, once the protective measures lift, we may find our immune systems weakened and perhaps more susceptible to viruses. The French paper talked about a respiratory illness that usually gets into very young children. Here locally, the caseload of this respiratory illness that we might see in December, we're seeing it now. And in younger children. So that's the curve that this particular piece of research was showing. Again, a lot of the docs are interested in the theory. We're just going to have to see if the theory plays out in real time.
That we are. Just to put some numbers on what you're saying and to pull this from your reporting in Ohio, last year, between September 2020 and I guess May of this year, only 122 people were hospitalized for flu during those months. And the previous flu season, more than 11,000. I mean, that's a significant,
dramatic.
I mean, completely dramatic.
Right.
So, I guess you also wonder, should you maybe consider putting a mask on every flu season?
That is something we're probably going to be doing from now on. At least during the flu season, we'll probably have to mask. I will.
Yeah,
I will.
I'm wondering how normal mask wearing might become for us. It's not unusual in other countries to, you know, when something's going around, throw a mask on. Some countries were more adaptable to that mitigation effort. Are you hearing any reporting or seeing any reporting on people's level of comfort with masking, even once we get past COVID as we know it now?
I've not seen any research on this yet, but I will tell you that people who love and care for the immunocompromised, if you have a child or a spouse or parent who is sick, I think this pandemic has only awakened in you and in your friends the awareness that a mask can be a lifesaver. And that's an important thing to keep in mind while you are going about your business, that it's, I think at least when you're in indoor spaces, that's going to be important through the flu season.
You spoke to someone for your coverage on this flu report, and forgive me, my monitor is frozen just a little bit, so I don't have his or her full name here. I believe it is someone with the last name of Schaffson.
Schaffson, yes.
Who was made a believer out of face mask.
Yes, he's the director of infection prevention and control at Children's Hospital, and he told me that before COVID, he did not think masks were very useful. And in fact, I remember at the time writing a story saying there's very little research at that time to show the efficacy of masks. And we, of course, have had a bunch of research since then on how powerful masks can be to prevent the spread of illness. And now Dr. Schaffson said, I'm a believer. I think it's important. I think we should do it. It's not a political device. It's a health device.
You know, to go back to something you were saying just moments ago, the way that information about this virus can sort of evolve even from day to day, especially with all the different outlets that might consume the information first and then disseminate it among the public. The messaging on masking at the very beginning of the pandemic in the United States was not supportive of that mitigation effort. And then it became a way of life. And now with these case counts going up after we took all of our masks off for a while, and now there's mixed restrictions on that, what are you hearing from medical professionals, if anything, or what have you observed as it relates to the argument about masking and whether they work at all, just in general facts aside?
People who work in the medical field, in from what I have experienced in my reporting, do not see masks as remotely controversial in any way. To them, it is a part of their uniform, part of their own equipment, and it baffles them that there would be an argument about this. And in the beginning, you're absolutely right. There was very little evidence a year ago, March, about masks for everybody. Now we have that evidence, and it's useful. We actually see it when you look at those surge curves every day. We can see when we were using masks, we were doing great. We brought it down. I don't know how. I mean, it's for a lot of the medical people just don't understand that this would be anyone would have an argument over this. Especially if you are around children or the elderly or people who are ill, have chronic disease. I don't think medical people see a problem with that.
One thing I can tell you, Ann Seeger, with absolute certainty is that this country is very adept at having an argument.
So true, Michael.
Ann Seeger is a reporter with the Cincinnati Inquirer. Ann, so glad to have you back on our program. I hope you are able to go out and enjoy the long weekend in spite of it all.
Thank you so much, Michael. It's good to hear your voice.
Thank you. And coming up, Cincinnati City employees will have to be vaccinated or submit to testing for COVID. And Northern Kentucky's congressman faces backlash over a tweet about vaccines and the Holocaust. This is the Weekly News Review on Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Senator Rand Paul, Kentucky's Republican junior senator, says hatred of former President Trump is stopping research on COVID-19 treatments. And Congressman Thomas Massie, the Northern Kentucky Republican, faces backlash over a tweet about vaccines. We're now joined by Inquirer reporter Scott Wortman. Scott, welcome back to Cincinnati Edition.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
It's our pleasure to have you back. And we were talking about the anti-parasitic drug ivermectin in both of our previous segments about how it is primarily used in animals as a deworming drug, is also prescribed in some capacity for humans, but is not approved by the FDA or prescribed to combat COVID-19 symptoms. You were in Cold Spring recently, and Kentucky Senator Rand Paul was also there, which is what brought you to Campbell County. And I'm curious why he thinks Donald Trump hatred is what's slowing research on ivermectin's potential efficacy in the fight against COVID.
Well, he basically just said that he doesn't, because he fielded a question. It was a cramped meeting with about 60 residents in the city council chambers in Cold Springs, which is Cold Springs. Sorry.
I was going to say, I cannot believe you put an S on the end of that.
I apologize.
We'll get letters.
I'm sure I'll get thanks emails on that. But he spoke for about 40 minutes, you know, against like socialism and that. And then he fielded questions from the audience, and a woman stood up and wanted to know why she can't get more ivermectin to prevent COVID, which you mentioned this earlier. There's no studies that show that, you know, that this has any effect whatsoever on COVID and can actually be dangerous. Poison control centers are getting calls on this, according to news reports, people overdosing on this. But he basically said that he hasn't seen any good research on this, and he thinks it's partisan issue because researchers like Dr. Anthony Fauci, who he's had public battles with, hate Trump and don't want to give any credence to any of these theories coming out of right-wing groups that, you know, that ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine are treatments for COVID.
That's right. He did name hydroxychloroquine as well, an anti-malarial drug that was touted as an effective, tool against COVID-19. President Trump was someone who touted the effectiveness of that. But again, it's not been fully researched. And so where does Senator Paul stand on taking these medicines, though? Does he suggest if you can get your hands on it that you should? Did he have anything to say about it?
He did not. He said that he doesn't know because researchers hate Trump and won't research it. Now, again, there's no evidence that that's the reason, you know, why this isn't being researched, because the FDA has said unequivocally, again, that there is no evidence that this can treat COVID and is, you know, dangerous to take. Just again, trying to make that clear, but. he said that no, he doesn't know whether he said he's keeping an open mind, basically.
So that's Senator Rand Paul. Northern Kentucky Congressman Thomas Massey, also a Republican, sort of in the style of Rand Paul and Ron Paul on that side of the Republican ideology. He got some pushback for a tweet in recent days that I don't know, did he ultimately delete it or what was
he
it?
Did.
He was comparing vaccine mandates to Holocaust. He's very outspoken and usually isn't afraid to double down on something he's getting pushback on, but this was different, it seems.
Yeah, he usually doesn't delete tweets. He usually stands by it, and he hasn't publicly spoken on this. But he tweeted out a meme that basically was a photo of a raised fist, a black and white photo with a serial number tattooed on the wrist, reminiscent of the numbers tattooed on prisoners at Auschwitz. And it just said, if you have to carry a card on you to gain access to a restaurant, you're not living in or a venue or event, you're not living in a free country, basically. And people reacted online against this, it being insensitive to survivors of the Holocaust, Jewish people. And he deleted the tweet, but not before people gathered, you know, got photos of it and shared it online. And an intern in his office actually resigned over it, saying that he can't stand by that and left.
Yeah, that's something I saw in your reporting. Someone named Andrew Zirkle, who, according to your report, identified himself on Twitter and LinkedIn as an intern for Massey's office. He did step down for that. So have we heard from Massey at all since then? I mean, he's usually pretty active on Twitter. I'm not necessarily saying about that tweet, but has he gone back to his regularly scheduled tweeting all day?
Yeah, I mean, he's still against vaccine mandates. He claims that he's not against vaccines, but just the law, you know, mandating that, and against mask laws and requirements. So he's not left, but he's not addressed that tweet specifically. He's just, I guess, hoping to move on from that.
Yeah, again, it's so strange because he is someone who is very outspoken and often uses the hashtag sassy with Massey when he knows he's said something that's going to get him attention. So we'll just have to follow.
And I could be wrong on this, but I mean, I'm not aware of him ever deleting a tweet before.
Yeah.
He usually doesn't care about blowback.
Right.
In fact, he usually invites it. So that was unusual.
We're talking with Scott Wortman from the Cincinnati Inquirer. And now I'd like to bring in WVXU reporter Becca Costello as we turn our attention to both of their reporting here in Cincinnati. And Becca, to keep the theme of COVID throughout this hour going, some employees in the city of Cincinnati, they're now facing a vaccine mandate, are they not?
Yes, although I will say it's definitely a choice. And so the choice is to receive, become fully vaccinated for COVID-19 or to submit weekly COVID-19 tests. And so that's testing that the City of Cincinnati employees would have to complete on their own and submit those results and they'd have to do that basically every week unless they are fully vaccinated.
So whose decision was this? Was this a vote by council or was this made at the administrative level?
This is an administrative decision. It was announced at council couple of days ago. The city manager, Paula Boggs-Muthing, said that this was a decision reached with several departments having input. They had a kind of an internal stakeholder group with the human resources department, the health department, as well as the city manager and the law department, and they developed this policy over the last few weeks. She said it also had input and even some changes, although those changes weren't specified, after some input from the unions.
Have we noticed, Becca, any pushback from employees, or did they offer up any numbers on like this many city employees or this percentage of city employees are vaccinated?
I have not seen any pushback so far, but it's still early days and that definitely could be possible. And again, it's a mandate only in the sense that, you know, they have to do that or do the testing, which given the availability of testing, it can even be an at-home test that the city could provide. That's not a huge ask, I think, on behalf of city employees. So they're not facing any kind of, you know, disciplinary action or firing or anything as a result of not getting vaccinated. And I'm sorry, what was the second part of the question?
No, that's all right. I did notice, though, that similar to the Hamilton County 513 bus that's going around to different communities and bringing the vaccine to people, if folks sign up for it, they get a $100 gift card. The city's offering money to people who get vaccinated if they're employed at the city.
That's right. And you mentioned that $100 incentive. That's basically the same. So if a city employee gets vaccinated at a city health department clinic, which they are offering three sort of special clinics specifically for city employees over the next week or so, they can get that $100 cash gift card. And I did remember you asked about the number of city employees or the percentage of city employees already vaccinated. Those aren't numbers that they've released before, but this is true at the county level as well. This will mean that the city is keeping track of the percentage of employees who are vaccinated. So those will be numbers that if they don't release publicly, we as the media can ask for that information at some point because they'll need to keep track of that information.
Well, now let's talk a little bit about the politics at City Hall. And Scott Wortman from The Inquirer is still with us. We've also got Becca Costello from WVXU. Becca, this was a busy week at Cincinnati City Council over some charter amendments, I believe. Can you just set the scene for us? And then we'll turn to Scott to get some perspective from Mayor John Cranley and the two men who hope to replace him.
Yeah, it was kind of a tense week at council, actually. They've been on summer recess for a while. They last met at the beginning of August, there were several charter amendments proposed by council members. So just as some context, there are two ways for a charter amendment to get on the ballot. One is for a council member to propose it, and if the majority of council approves that, it will be sent to the ballot. The other way for a charter amendment to be on the ballot for voters to see is for residents to basically get thousands of signatures from other residents and put that on by petition. So there were two examples of that, or one example of each of those at council this week. And the one that I think is likely to cause the most controversy and has already sparked some strong words from City Hall was put forward by State Representative Tom Brinkman. It is a single charter amendment technically, but there are several things that it would change. It covers a myriad of issues from lowering the salary level of council members to allowing for a recall option to recall the mayor, and certainly lots of, as I said, strong words in opposition to that from most folks on council.
And Scott, that also includes Cincinnati Mayor John Cranley, who has called some of this a Republican effort to take over the city.
Correct, yes. Basically, the mayor is afraid, and there's a variety of reasons why he feels that this could, and it's not just Mayor Cranley, feel this could shake up the makeup of city council and elect more Republicans. But one of the most concerning to him was the provision that would allow for the recall of the mayor. He likened it to the situation out in California with Gavin Newsom. But basically, you could have a mayor that does something that some people don't like, get a recall effort on the ballot, and then have someone that just has a plurality but not a majority of the voter support, like maybe 20%, become mayor. And so he feels that this is a way to get Democrats out of City Hall. And both the people running to replace John Cranley take an equally dim view of this amendment.
Yeah, help us understand where Aftab Purval and David Mann, the two candidates running for mayor this November, where do they stand on it?
They also do not like it. The biggest, probably the most controversial part of this is slashing the city council pay, to tying it basically to the median household income of the city. Council members make right now about $65,000. The median household income right now is about $45,000, $46,000. And their argument, it's not just, again, Aftab Purval and David Mann, but a lot of people are questioning, like, well, how is slashing pay going to get better people to represent the city?
Becca, what are we hearing from other members of council specifically about that particular component of the charter amendment, whether they would be supportive of lowering their own pay? I know a lot of the council members won't be back next year for charter reasons, but what did we hear, if anything?
Well, the one person who spoke in favor pretty strongly is Republican Betsy Sunderman. And her point in supporting that is basically that city council is considered a part-time job. The current pay for city council is about $60,000 a year, which does sound like a lot of money for a part-time job. And most council members are employed outside of city hall elsewhere. But many other council members spoke up and said it may be on paper considered a part-time job, but realistically it's not. Vice Mayor Christopher Smitherman spoke pretty strongly against this piece, saying that basically if you have a family on the city's health insurance plan and this pay is slashed in such a way that you'd basically be taking home just $1,000 or $2,000 a month. And so the idea is that basically, as Scott said, the argument is it will effectively mean that only people who are independently wealthy or have enough of financial stability to run for council that they don't have to worry about the salary, which would not be representative of the city's residency, it would be basically folks who are able to afford to take a pay cut or quit their job in order to be on city council, and that would be a bad thing for city politics.
Well, if it
independent
were, very
Chris
quickly.
Smitherman also, or oh, I'm sorry, but independent Chris Smitherman, independent council member Smitherman also argued that it is an enormous job, that it is more than full time. So
yeah.
That.
Well, if it were up to me, I would increase the pay. WVXU reporter Becca Costello and Inquirer reporter Scott Wartman for spending time with us today. Thanks to both of you. Hope you have a good long weekend.
Thank you.
Thanks, Michael.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Our assistant producer is Nick Swartzel. Our technical director is Josh Elstro. Our Facebook live feed is produced by Ronnie Salerno. I'm Michael Monks. We'll talk again after the long Labor Day weekend. Hope you have a good one.